What if every student had a tutor and personalized learning was available to everyone? What if every family had a financial guide and their investments made for an optimistic future? What if every doctor could diagnose you in seconds and healthcare visits felt more personal? What if your business never slept and every customer's shopping experience felt like it was designed especially for them? It can with Agentforce, the powerful AI from Salesforce.
This is CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Space, America's new strategic front line. I welcome Henry Sikorsky, the executive director of the Nonproliferation Policy Education Center, issuing a report right now about space and what we need to know as we go forward into a militarized low Earth orbit, into a militarized moon basing, into a militarized Russia colonies on Mars. All of that is imaginable in the 21st century. We're militarized on Earth, and therefore, what is to be done? Henry, a very good evening to you. The four sections of your volume, and it's more than 350 pages, address the questions that are evident right now from the point of view of the Space Command, the United States, and our allies. So I go to the larger story of what is to be done immediately in low Earth orbit. I'm limiting myself to low Earth orbit because that's where the satellites are, and that's the conversation about any satellite affairs. You bring forward the viewpoints of what is to be done for low Earth orbit. The first possibility, I follow the reporting in your summary, is spacefaring partners should proliferate thousands of dual-use and dedicated military low Earth orbit satellites it would be difficult for China or Russia to knock out. In other words, we flood the zone. What is your understanding? Is that a popular position? Is that Space Command? Good evening to you.
Good evening. It's the prevalent conventional wisdom that our way out of the threats posed by lasers and robot satellites that could damage, defuel, or move into bad position our satellites. It's just to have so many satellites that kind of game it becomes very, very difficult to prevail. And the notion is, well, we'll get a lot of satellites, thousands of them up, they network, and we'll be able to replace them very quickly and very cheaply with new forms of inexpensive reusable launch vehicles. And there you go. We're done. I think that is rebuttable. I don't think that's a complete thought. And to the credit of the Space Force, they don't think that either entirely. They want to have systems that can operate at different orbits besides low Earth orbit. And eventually, I think they're eager to get enough payloads into space that will have the ability to move around. In other words, the payload would include enough fuel on these vehicles so that they can change orbits more quickly than they can now. But the prevailing wisdom is just let Starlink blossom. And, the idea is that the private sector will have lots of proliferated systems that will be exploitable by the military. The military will have proliferated systems that it can use in low Earth orbit. And anyone trying to take this stuff down is going to have a handful. It's just going to be very, very difficult. So that's the prevailing view.
And you introduced, I think, within these last days in our conversation, the very like possibility that the commercial enterprises, I'm thinking of Starlink, the Kuiper system from Blue Origin, and OneWeb, which is an independent organization focusing on communications for businesses, all of those would become military targets. Is that correct, Henry?
Well, the Russians just announced this week that if they believe a commercial system's being used for military purposes, it's fair game. Now, this is, I call this the space Lusitania problem in reference to the famous liner Lusitania that was sunk by the Germans because they said it was carrying war goods. So there may not be sanctuary. Of course, our military will have military dedicated constellations as well, but of course those will be, legitimate targets in war. And the question is, to what extent will these low Earth systems work? When will they come online? There was a terrific piece, I believe, I think it was in The Economist, saying that there may be an implosion of the space communications large constellation provider market, that folks are going to turn to ground-based systems in a lot of ways soon. And there'll be so much competition with Mr. Musk's Starlink that there'll be a massive consolidation and not all these systems will get built. But, you know, this remains to be seen. The other problem that is raised in a game that, and in the book, you know, China and North Korea could legally even explode a nuclear device by lobbing it, not putting it in orbit. And the Chinese have spoken about this publicly. Now, I don't know how realistic that is, but it certainly is something that puts a hole, literally, in the argument that these proliferated systems are enough and they'll do the business, and all you need are passive defenses. This is why some of the people writing in the volume talk about the need to have different orbits for different missions and to be able to engage in pushing, at least, if not destroying, pushing certain satellites that are hostile approaching ours away from them. These are called bodyguard systems. We do not publicly have a bodyguard satellite program. The Chinese do, and the Russians have already exercised using it, as have the Chinese. So, you know, all of this is discussed in the volume.
Yes, that a scenario of exploding a nuclear device in order to damage the satellite constellations, that's the fourth section of your book, War Games.
Yes.
And that would be one of the scenarios.
There are three space games there. They're like small books because I think I held by hand. I did not put all of the transcripts in, but the transcripts for each one of those games is several hundred pages. I spared the reader that. And, but, you know, they were major undertakings. You can only do one of those a year. That's how much effort has to go into those.
And the games are played by a variety of individuals who come to this with experience of war on Earth, and war in space looks a lot like it. It's attached to a sovereign power such as North Korea. Now, the second view of low Earth orbit is to either prevent it from being militarized or to demilitarize it. Is that a large conversation in Washington, to your knowledge, Henry?
It is also in the diplomatic realm or core, not only in the United States, but certainly elsewhere, a predominant, and I would say dominant, view. And that is that space should be viewed as something like it was in 1959 or something, as a place of sanctuary, that nothing should be done untoward with regard to these objects that we put in space, and they shouldn't do anything hostile to anything on Earth. Now, that's a bit of a fiction for all sorts of reasons, but I think it's a very popular view, and it argues that what we need to do is have plenty of rules and guidelines that try to get agreement on to make sure that no one comes to blows and no one harms anybody in space, and that everyone keeps their distance. And to be honest, you know, as much as I'm attracted to the idea of space superiority, it's not like the diplomatic suggestions that come from that sanctuary school can be totally dismissed. You have to pay attention to them. Sometimes they make sense.
The puzzle also about what is to be done in space involves the idea that you take control of it. You dominate
Yes.
the story. And this would be Space Force times X in order to dominate low Earth orbit. Is that
Yes.
discussed in Washington?
Not enough. In fact, the people that discuss this in a full, clear-throated way, I think are considered slightly intense, which is code for, in Washington, crazy. I don't think they're crazy. I think they've got a point. We have, if you look at all the Space Force material. I think they go as far as one can in this direction under government, but I don't think they take the last step. What am I saying? What they do is they say, well, we need to be able to defend against attacks. And that means that we need to be able to, you know, survive being hit. So that certainly captures the passive defense things that we're talking about, proliferation, replenishment. They don't talk, I think, at all in a clear-throated way about being able to harm or disable other satellites of other countries. And I think you got to start talking about that, because I think unless you can do that, you're going to be in trouble. I think there's a medium between those two aggressive formulations, passive and, you know, active defense. And that is, at least we should be creating bodyguard systems where satellites can at least move hostile satellites away from very important military satellites the U.S. has. And that kind of force is not talked about. And I'm not sure, since it's talked about, we're going to have it. And if we are, we'll have it in the number or at the time we need it. And that came out in an earlier war game, which is not in this volume, but a previous one. So it's a problem. I think we need to be more willing to talk about what space superiority requires. I think it requires active defenses, but beyond that, an ability to disable other people's satellites. And people just feel very uncomfortable about that. I think finally, we do need bodyguards, which might prevent you from having to go to blows in the first place.
I want to highlight Laura Montgomery's contribution to the book, because I've talked to Ms. Montgomery over the years many times about the Outer Space Treaty, about attempts during the Cold War in some fashion to anticipate these problems before there was the technology and the success and the commercialization of low Earth orbit. What I want to raise is, how does the Artemis Accord fit into this? Because so many nations have signed on, and there's the presumption this is about the moon, but it's easy enough to influence all decisions made in space now and going forward. Does that change things for Washington, the Artemis Accords?
Well, it's given them an approach. Needless to say, the Chinese and Russians have a different approach.
Yes, they've not signed.
They're selling their goods as well as ours. We're in a competition to get subscribers to different moon programs right now. I think it shows a way to popularize certain rules. I don't think the Artemis Accords are complete enough to be the rule set that we need to deal with the problems we were just talking about, however. Most people refer to the Outer Space Treaty as some form of relief. But the beauty of the essay that Ms. Montgomery writes is showing that while in some respects we haven't interpreted the Outer Space Treaty the way it could be, and that would probably prohibit what's called fractioning orbiting missiles, or these hypersonics that China is developing. For some reason, our military has reserved the right to do the same and isn't willing to interpret the treaty to say that that shouldn't be allowed. She's willing to go there. On the other hand, there are an awful lot of things, including lobbing a nuclear explosive that doesn't go into orbit and setting it off, that is permitted. So there are limits to what that treaty will afford in the way of restraint, if you will.
Henry Sikorsky is the executive director of the Nonproliferation Policy Education Center. This study, it's a sizable document, 350 pages, can be referred to as a book, is now available online. Space, America's New Strategic Front Line. We're going to turn to another story that is related to this because it has ballistic missiles involved, conventional ballistic missile warheads. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 million protection package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.
There's a time and a place for Filet-O-Fish, but breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.